Now, there was a motion before the Dáil today, a People Before Profit solidarity motion, looking to withdraw plans for legislation to end the triple lock, to commit to a referendum on enshrining neutrality in the constitution, and to end the use of Shannon Airport by the US military. We're going to start with the first issue of that, the triple lock tonight. But Jennifer, Irish neutrality, what is it? How is it defined in Ireland?
So it's a good question, because people always say, oh, Ireland is neutral. But we have a very much an Irish solution to an Irish problem. We say we adhere to the idea of peace and friendly cooperation and adhere to the principles of international public international law on these issues. But we don't actually say the word neutrality. Now, we did post some of the European referendums. We put in a special provision on blocking us from, say, a common defence policy. But it is something that is open to interpretation, because there is no word saying we are neutral in the constitution.
At the moment, the practice is that it requires the triple lock. Is what? Would you explain that?
Yeah, and there's a lot of talk about triple lock between here and England. The English one is pensions, just to make that clear, because some people are just seeing triple locks everywhere. So the one that we operate here is you literally have to get three yeses to deploy troops. Your first one is the cabinet, then the Oireachtas, and then the UN Security Council. And the reason why it's coming into focus is because, to put it mildly, the UN Security Council is pretty much banjaxed right now, because it's predominantly controlled by those who won World War II, who aren't quite getting on at the moment. So they all need to be singing off the same hymn sheet if there is to be a deployment. For just peacekeepers, we might then get called and say, can you bring some of the lads to the table to do this job? And the thing is, the issues of the Security Council have been there for years. It's just they're particularly under a microscope now with Ukraine and with what's going on in Gaza and Palestine. So that is the key issue to that triple lock aspect. And some people are saying, yes, let's get rid of it, but we still need to have checks and balances on it. But at the end of the day, with the reality, we don't have enough people in the defence forces. We can barely get one ship out of port. So it's not like we've got battalions hanging around the country, twiddling their thumbs, looking for something to do. We can have that theoretical debate about it, but even if we are to reform it, we probably won't have enough people to bring to the table to do those jobs they envisage us doing.
All right. And the last UN peacekeeping mission that was approved by the Security Council was in the Central African Republic in 2014. I think Ireland was participated in the second last one to be approved, the one in Mali. Richard Boyd-Barrett, People Before Profit Solidarity, want to keep the triple lock in place. You're no fan of the post World War II world order, I'm sure, and who were the dominant powers thereafter? So why give them the say over Irish foreign policy?
Yeah, it would be a problem if we did, but of course that's not the actual case. The 2006 Defence Act says that we can deploy troops either with the approval of the Security Council or with a majority on the General Assembly. So we absolutely agree there's a major problem with the dominance of the major powers. But it's a complete red herring to say that the government are constrained by the Security Council, because they're not, legally, they're not at all. And in fact, that same Defence Act allows us to deploy on humanitarian missions and on regional peacekeeping missions without UN Security Council approval. So when the government goes at the triple lock, they use that as the cover, which is not true, and the facts need to be got out there. But what are they really, what's the real agenda in getting rid of the triple lock? It is, as we heard today from the government, their argument that after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, they want to have the freedom to deploy troops more on a more willy-nilly basis. And our argument is what that actually means is, as the project of EU militarisation and its ever closer alignment with NATO, it means freeing the government up to be able to deploy troops in military missions dominated by the NATO powers like the US, Britain and so on. And, you know, you just think they allowed 2 million troops to go through, US troops to go Shannon Airport to prosecute a war. We could have been involved in that war except for things like the triple lock.
We'll get to the use of Shannon Airport shortly. Mary Siri Kearney, you've heard Richard Boyd-Barrett outline the reasons why his group in the Dáil want to keep the triple lock. Do you want to answer any of those first, and why do you want to get rid of it?
Well, the fact is that the triple lock, for reasons outlined, is no longer working. Why should we have that the UN decide our foreign policy, whether it's the General Assembly or the Security Council? Our foreign policy should be decided within the borders of Ireland and by the people that are elected by the people of Ireland. There is no question, absolutely no question, of us joining NATO and getting into any military alliances like that. There is no question. It's not on the table. It has been several times government has said, we are not doing this. You know, we held the Forum on International Security last year, and they having real grown-up conversations about things like our cybersecurity, our the security of our state and our foreign policy in the current environment, were completely hijacked by complete red herrings of NATO, when that is not the case.
Is NATO,
so we need
itself,
to be a bit grown up about our own...
Is joining NATO in and of itself, or not joining NATO, maybe a complete red herring as well, in that missions could be set up and led by a particular party. Ireland may not have to join formally the military alliance, but they could, in the absence of the triple lock, participate in missions like that.
But something like that would have to be ruled on by the government, would have to decide it, and the Dáil would have to decide it. But we're not going anywhere near there. Ireland prides itself on its peacekeeping and its international reputation for peacekeeping. We pride ourselves on that.
Okay.
That is why we have defined our foreign policy since the foundation of the state. That is where we want to go. Nobody is trying to undermine that at all.
Okay, Cathal Bearnaí, first of all, I mean, do you support the removal of the triple lock, and what do you make of the proposals in today's motion and what Richard just said?
I very much support a review of it. We should always be reviewing all policies. And we have three options on the table, basically. You can leave well enough alone, leave the triple lock there. You can, option number two is you can return to a double lock, which served us well from 1960 up to 2002. And the third option, and Richard just mentioned it there, we could look at more exemptions through the 2006 Defence Act. So there's a number of exemptions, there's 8 at the moment, and we could add a few more in. So we could tweak our own national policy, basically. There's also a threshold of 12, so you can't send more than 12 without the triple lock being needed. We could increase that number to 30 or 50 if we wish. It's entirely a national competence. So there are three options: leave well enough alone, return to a double lock, or tweak the 2006 Defence Act.
And the issue between the Security Council and the General Assembly provided for, Richard Boyd-Barrett said, in the Defence Act, do you have concerns around how workable that is in terms of, you know, who decides ultimately on peacekeeping missions and how often they're decided on?
Yeah, so the big practical issue is Ireland, for instance, would like be able to conduct an evacuation operation autonomously on its own. We would have liked to have sent a close protection team with Simon Coveney, with the Taoiseach, to Ukraine, for instance, or we'd like to be able to work with our embassies in Africa in hostile or non-permissive environments. If you go to the General Assembly or even the Security Council and ask them for permission to move about 30 Irish troops, I mean, you'd be laughed out of the room. It's not appropriate at all to be dealing with national competence issues at an international forum like that, and that's where the issue is. The triple lock has to stay, for instance. Every country in the world has a triple lock for blue beret missions. You can't put a blue beret on your head or a blue helmet on your head unless it's been approved by a triple lock scenario. The issue with Ireland is, and we're unique here, that we extended that triple lock to all our military deployments. And that's where the 2006 list of exemptions came in, because we could, in theory, send the army soccer team to France because there was only 11 of them, but we couldn't send the army rugby team because there was 15 of them and the threshold is 12. So we scrambled for a solution, came up with a list of exemptions, and we could look, and Richard was saying, we could look at 2006 exemptions as a plan C. There's a lot of common ground there. If we wanted to include hostage rescue operations, evacuation operations, close protection operations for ministers, or working with our embassies, or drug interdiction operations with neighbours. That's another option.
Richard Boyd-Barrett, could you see any of those exemptions being included in an amended Defence Act that maybe then would answer some of the arguments advanced by the critics of what your proposal is in terms of, you know, deploying limited protection teams and the like overseas?
Well, first of all, I'm not convinced that that is actually the case, that there's been any serious deployments that, and we challenged the government several times to say, what deployments have you been prevented from making that you would like to have made but couldn't because of the triple lock?
Well, the one that has been advanced before is a proposal to participate in a mission in Macedonia, which, in the absence of a mandate which was blocked by China, the defence forces couldn't participate in, I think, in 2003.
Yeah, well, first of all, that China may have vetoed it at the Security Council. Is that the reference you're making?
Yeah.
Yeah, but if we had a concern with that, that is something you could raise at the General Assembly, right? If we had a concern about it. But because, as I said, it isn't just the Security Council that's in the Defence Act. The General Assembly, a majority, can allow for deployments. But our concern is, at the moment, and this is a political view, but I think it's one many share, is that the Irish government have wanted to align themselves with a process of greater EU militarisation, which in turn is aligned with NATO. And the powers that dominate NATO are the same powers that, for example, at the moment, are arming to the teeth Israel as they commit a genocide in Gaza. Now, we do not want to be in any military relationship with states that are capable of arming, supporting, justifying a genocide being committed of the sort that we're seeing in Gaza. Right. So the only protection we have against our government being able to send troops in military deployments that might involve those sorts of powers, like we saw in Iraq or Afghanistan, is the triple lock. And by the way,
all right, but before I'll get a contribution from the rest of our the panel on that. But I suppose since military neutrality was introduced during the course of the emergency in 1939, the triple lock wasn't needed for Ireland to stay out, for example, of the Second World War, during which time they were under enormous pressure from both Britain and America to enter the war.
Yeah, but at the moment, there is an absolutely discernible push by successive governments, and we saw it most egregiously, in my opinion, during the Iraq War, where they, in my opinion, massively breached neutrality by allowing 2 million US troops to go through Shannon to prosecute a war that was based on a pack of lies and that killed 1 million people. Now, I do not want the sons and daughters of working class people in this country to be sent participating in bloody wars like Iraq, Afghanistan, or anywhere else that the powers that dominate NATO might want to make a war.
I'll come back to you, Jennifer, just on the use of Shannon, but just on the prospects of entering into conflicts like that, Ciarán Kearney, do you want to respond to that?
There is no prospect of us. There is no plan. There is no discussion that we're going to militarily align and that we're going to start deploying Irish defence forces, such as they are depleted at the moment. In actual fact, we're investing in increasing their relevance and their capacity and capability. There is absolutely none. This is a total... I don't know how to coin it, actually, but it flies in the face of every single thing that's constantly said. And what Richard is proposing is that we need the UN to ensure that we can trust our government not to send our army. What a load of nonsense, to be perfectly honest. It's absolutely nonsense. We are not deploying militarily. We are, at every possible opportunity, the government reiterates our military neutrality.
Okay, Colin
at
Byrne.
Every possible opportunity.
Just finally, look, I think the double lock served us well from 1960 to 2002. There isn't a single example of anyone abusing that process. And just something that hasn't really been mentioned before, but most of that time for the double lock, it was a single party government. We now pretty much have coalition government. So there's an extra layer of security there within the Irish national apparatus. Another fact that is never really mentioned as well is Article 52 of Chapter 8 of the UN Charter. And it's very, very specific that you do not need a United Nations Security Council resolution. They actually encourage regional actors to deploy locally to solve disputes in their locality, in
this
their neighbourhood.
The African Union, is it?
Yes, provided it's in keeping with the principles and the purposes of the United Nations. So they actually encourage that. They would prefer regional arrangements to solve regional issues rather than referring them to New York. So that's just two other factors just to bear in mind.
All right. Jennifer Kavanagh, Brendan Howland made a point today in the course of the debate that said effectively stepping away from the triple lock and removing a role from the UN would undermine the UN itself at a time when the UN needs support.
Yes, and just on the point about the General Assembly, that there is a provision that if there is logjam in the Security Council that they can go to the General Assembly, and we've seen that with Ukraine, where they couldn't get anything through the Security Council, so went back down to a vote of the General Assembly. But the UN is staffed by diplomats. They do not want to raise the stakes. They want to negotiate and try and smooth everything out. So when it comes to, say, the issue with Shannon, that was the Horgan case, and it comes down to the executive.
Just explain that.
So wasn't that the few people who were arrested for attacking some of the US planes?
Yes, yes.
And it was Horgan against Taoiseach, and they said these issues come down to the executive. And remember as well that once you're past security, you're technically in an international law area as well. So there's a couple of different layers on that that make it a complex issue. But there is nothing stopping us from the legislation.
And in that judgment...
The weapons going through, there's nothing stopping us from saying that we need to check what's going through.
Absolutely.
There.
And it's outrageous that when US planes and a US general went through Shannon in a plane there the other day, we've no idea what was on that plane.
Yeah. But are you encouraged at all by, I think Mary Alice Higgins in the Shannon had a private member's bill about inspections of planes, and Eamon Ryan wasn't against it. He said he'd consult with officials in the Department of Transport, he'd consult with the Department officials of the Department of Foreign Affairs. He sounded personally in favour of having such a regime, so he doesn't sound like a guy who thinks there's anything to hide.
Well, let's see. But they have, for 7 months of a massacre in Gaza, they haven't inspected those planes. And I have to dispute this business that it's sort of, you know, scaremongering or whatever about the government's intention to align with NATO.
Sit onto the mic, yeah,
we have had NATO generals in Cork twice inspecting our troops. We've had
but just to ensure that is a separate issue to Shannon Airport, which we're talking about at the moment. So
I'm responding to an earlier point, Colin, which is important, right? That there's no reason to be concerned. There is a reason to be concerned, because allowing 2 million troops to go through Shannon to prosecute a bloody war based, I repeat, on a pack of lies about weapons of mass destruction that killed 1 million people in Iraq, that was a serious breach. That would lead any reasonable person to say there are question marks over Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael's commitment to neutrality. Okay. And if you look at their counter motion today to our motion, it's set as the international context for, quote, reviewing the triple lock, only reference to Russia and Ukraine. It didn't mention the involvement of the powers that dominate NATO with the genocide in Gaza. Now, why the one-sided framing of the question?
Okay, just to bring it back to Shannon Airport, because the motion does cover that and ending the use of the Shannon Airport by the US military. You've said a number of times that effectively there is, you seem to indicate there's a likelihood or a risk or a danger that armaments to supply Israel are passing through Shannon Airport. But you're saying that in the absence of proof, aren't you?
Because we don't inspect the planes and we want the planes inspected. And as I said, because we facilitated rendition flights, the kidnap and subsequent torture of people, or flights that were strongly believed to be involved in the kidnapping and torture of people, bringing them to Guantanamo Bay, and we facilitated troops going to Iraq and Afghanistan. Yeah, do we trust the Americans? No. We don't trust them to tell the truth about what's on those planes.
Mary Siri Kearney, when you look at what America's definition of its red lines are in the current conflict in Gaza, it doesn't believe what's going on at the moment is a fully fledged incursion. And America and Ireland obviously has different views and definitions of what's acceptable and appropriate in the context where military is being used. Should the government look at denying the US the use of Shannon Airport by its military?
Well, any flights require diplomatic clearance. And the fact is that there are strict conditions within that, and that they are implemented. And if the minister has said in the Shannon today, unfortunately, I missed where he said that, but I presume it's on the record of the Shannon, that he is open to the idea of inspecting planes, then that is going further, and that is being prepared to demonstrate that we are going to be even stricter in enforcing what is our diplomatic clearance, what is our requirements around the use of Shannon Airport. But the facts are, the facts that certainly I've been supplied with, is that no flights that are transferring weapons and transporting weapons come through Ireland and have landed in Ireland and have come through. So the fact is that it isn't happening in the way that is being alleged.
I suppose we are speaking in the area of, I suppose, nobody knows that the assumption is being made. The minister said he'd look into bringing forward legislation on this. Carl Berry, what do you think of the use of Shannon Airport, such much as it is by the US military. Do they have to come through there? And if Ireland was to deny it to them, what would the reaction be, in your estimation?
Look, great question. If there's any ever sensitive stores like munitions or missiles being transported from the continental United States anywhere in Europe, they'll just refuel them mid-air over the Atlantic and fly directly to Europe or beyond. So there's no requirement for them to land in Shannon in any shape or form. Military aircraft can refuel mid-air, and that's what they do. The Shannon arrangement has been there for decades. You probably remember the Fines seaplane base, the US seaplane base during the Second World War. Obviously, Shannon is just a couple of hundred metres off the estuary. It's been a long-standing arrangement. People are entitled to innocent passage through the airport. And it has been used as a diplomatic hub as well in recent years. A lot of American diplomats and politicians land in the VIP lounge, as you're aware. They interact with our politicians, and some foreign leaders as well have negotiations here. So it's very important from a hub perspective.
Jennifer Coveney, you mentioned that when you enter the area of Shannon Airport, you're in an international zone. So legislatively, legally, are there different requirements there? There's pre-clearance on Shannon, there's this Chicago.
We can actually come back to America on this, because they've done some very funny stuff. So basically, international law isn't like the law of contract. It's the law of, so far as everyone's going to support it, and diplomatics and everything. So what used to happen was Cayman Island bankers would land in Miami to get a transfer to a European flight. The amount of those who were actually in a transfer lounge and got arrested. So to be questioned, to find out who was the money, where's the money, are they paying tax on it? So it's law insofar as we'll keep it law until somebody actually goes in and does something. We'll probably make a lot of noise and saying you shouldn't be doing this, but at the end of the day, how are you going to punish them? So that's where you've a couple of layers going on of the law, the navigation, transport, all that sort of stuff. But then the fact that it gets breached an awful lot. And that's the quirky thing with public international law, the law of war. Everyone can see that things that might be going on are genocide, like as we're looking at in Palestine. But until you can actually punish the individual, because, at the end of the day, with, say, the ICJ ruling on Rafah, there's not really much they can do until all the other countries start saying, well, actually, you've broken this judgment. We are now going to start making life difficult for you. So that's where law in this area isn't so much the law you think of in, say, family law and a divorce or criminal law. It's a quirky area of law that is very political at the end of the day.
Okay. We at the outset of this, Jennifer mentioned that we're arguing really about the principle rather than the practicality. The Defence Forces, in terms of their force strength, are down at about 7,900, which is way below where they're supposed to be. So, Cathal Berry, the issue of deployment overseas in their current form, it's kind of moot at this stage, isn't it?
Absolutely. In fact, we're going in the opposite direction. So about 2 months ago, the government had to withdraw our Syrian contingent. We had 133 troops there. And for the first time in Irish military history, we have withdrawn from missions before, but as a general rule, it was when the mission was over or another contingent was replacing us. This is the first time we've ever had to withdraw because we just couldn't man it anymore. And so it reflects very, very poorly from our reputation perspective. Our troop numbers 15 years ago were 10,500. And now they're only 7,500. So if the government is trying to militarise Ireland, they're certainly going the wrong way about it.
All right. Mary Siri Kearney, you have a situation whereby, during the time of the Celtic Tiger, you could have made the same arguments that are being advanced now as to why things are the way they are in the Defence Forces, rising wages in the private sector, etc., etc., etc. But the truth is, a lot of people have departed the Defence Forces because of the way it's been structured, because of pay arrangements and because of morale.
Well, I think the implementation and the action plan on the implementation of the Commission on the Defence Forces is aimed at arresting that lack of morale, is aimed at ensuring that we have a capital spend. The budget last year was the largest that we have had. It was to allow for cyber technology and other improvements along the way. And so we're up at 1.17 billion of a spend. So the implementation of that has to be accelerated and has to be delivered on. It's an excellent report. So, I've seen the action plan on it. The measurement of that action plan needs to be reported on an annual basis. But certainly we need to be increasing, and investing thoroughly in our defence forces. If we claim neutrality, neutrality requires that we're actually able to defend ourselves, defend our airspace, defend our land, to, you know, defend our seas. And we're not able to do that at the moment. Right. So we need to be doing that.
Richard Boyd Barrett, you know, if the force strength was to be got up to around the 11,000 mark where it's supposed to be, and if Ireland was to be able to take on peacekeeping missions like the ones it's had to withdraw to, how would you like to see them equipped and where would you like to see them deployed?
Well, first of all, I'd like to see them paid properly because that's the main reason. And indeed, I've been speaking out on behalf of rank and file soldiers recently who've contacted me precisely because of the extremely poor paying conditions and the struggle they have just to keep a roof over their head. So let's start with that, the welfare of the actual rank and file in the army. In fact, I raised today in the Dáil again, you know, just little petty things that soldier, like a soldier who had served in everywhere, Chad, Liberia, whatever, and was denied what's called his presentation after he retired because he'd made a protected disclosure about what he felt were dangerous practices using chemicals in
sure,
the Navy.
Sure, I suppose
right?
all of the people who join up and they want the proper treatment, but they also signed up to do a particular job which they had an interest in.
And
would you like to see them do that?
I'd like to see them in places where their reputation as people who are not aligned with either of the military big power blocks in the world or any of the big military power blocks is protected, because that is their best protection. Because if we want to look after the welfare of our soldiers, the Ireland's reputation as a neutral country and as a country that is not aligned with America, Britain, Russia, China, or any of the big powers who are now involved in a dangerous escalation of geopolitical rivalry, right? We need to stay out of any association with that to protect the well-being of our soldiers. And that's why I think the triple lock is important, because it prevents us from lining up with one side. Right.
Although we have incurred the most casualties of any country in UNIFIL, some of whom are NATO members. I think at 48 is the number who have been killed out there. That's more than the French, the Spanish and other people who are NATO members.
Yeah, and I don't want to see more killed.
Okay.
I don't want to see more killed. And more would be killed if we were freed up to involve ourselves with NATO-dominated missions.
Okay. Jennifer Cabinet, cybersecurity is another concern for Ireland. You know, it's been argued that, you know, Ireland is nowhere geographically near a front line, although there's been some doubts cast on that perhaps more recently. But in the area of cybersecurity, that's an area that that Ireland has been told to up its game.
Yeah, sure. At a basic level, all the data cables go through Irish territorial seas, and we don't really have any way of actually protecting those. We have all the social media giants have all their European headquarters here. You know, it might be part of the more lax regulation which is being stepped up, but we do have to bear in mind that all that stuff is happening in this jurisdiction. It is stuff that bad actors do want to interfere with, even looking at, say, the local and European elections. The people that are watching this stuff are very mindful of different countries trying to get involved or different groups. So we have to be very careful of that, where we might just be a rock hanging off the side of Europe, but we are an important rock.
All right. Mary Siri Kearney, there's a compelling argument on behalf of protecting national investment. Why wasn't national sovereignty enough to make that investment before this in Irish security?
Because I suppose borders have changed. The concept of borders and jurisdiction has changed. The concept of how war is waged has changed. We have the fact now that our country is under cyber attack. Our businesses are under cyber attack. The undermining of our economic sovereignty occurs all of the time. The National Cyber Security Centre under Richard Brown are just fantastic. They have been ramped up in recent years, but that needs to continue, and their work needs to continue as we respond, particularly when you have generative AI, when you have other the developments
how far off the
seem
mark
to move ahead. Well, I think unfortunately the technology seems to move quicker than than we can respond to it. And we need to be ensuring that we are increasing our investment all of the time. The risk assessment, the national risk assessment of 2023, one of the five headings in that was looking at technology, looking at the impact and the risks of that and where we need to focus our budgetary spend, ensuring that we have sufficient capacity and capability to at a national level to defend ourselves from cyber attack. But also you'll see, you know, Enterprise Ireland, the local enterprise supports for local businesses. There's courses, there's programs, there's money there to make sure the businesses are robust, because we're all under, we now have a strategy that we have to look at who's the inward investment into our universities, who's funding the research in your universities, who owns our intellectual property. And under the European security strategy, they're all obligations now on member states to ensure that we're vetting who owns what in Ireland, and that Ireland is strategically posed and defending ourselves and defending our intellectual property.
Does that sound fairly fragmented to you, Cathal Berry, the number of agencies that Ciarán Kearney has listed there?
It does, but to be fair, there is a glimmer of hope from a cyber point of view, admittedly from a very low base. I mean, in the last 3 years since the HSE cyber attack, the headcount has doubled, the budget has doubled, new premises have been provided. So if only we could apply the same template to the Defence Force like we did to the National Cyber Security Centre. And Mary makes a good point about resourcing. This is what neutrality means to me, right? We don't join alliances, we don't enter into common defence arrangements. And on that basis, we resource our own independent defence forces properly. So our problem, like any policy, is we have a policy, but we haven't resourced it. So we have the Royal Air Force looking after airspace. We have the French Navy in our economic waters at the moment. I mean, that is the antithesis of what neutrality is. So if you're going to have a policy, you need to resource it. Otherwise, you're just whistling at the wind.
All right. Agree. Richard Boyd-Barrows?
Well, first of all, I don't see any military threat to this country. And I think the government are talking it up because they want to move away from neutrality for reasons I've already said. But if you take the HSE attack, I certainly think we need to address things like that. And that's about properly funding cybersecurity in the health service.
Okay, but I suppose
it's the one that's always cited. So
what about national fisheries? You know, in terms of protecting super trawlers coming into our coastal waters.
Absolutely, I am for that. But I want to stress, right? While I wouldn't trust the Russians, as far as I could, the Russian state, I want to stress, not the people, the Russian state or the Chinese state, in terms of, you know, trying to interfere for its own advantage. Nor do I trust Elon Musk or the people who run Facebook or,
So you find yourself in agreement with Cathal Berry that it should really be a state-directed enterprise rather than outsourced to the private sector.
It should be absolutely a public enterprise, without a shadow of a doubt.
And we can't outsource this to the Castletown Bear fishermen going out and telling the Russian Navy to move because we're always fishing there.
Jennifer Kavanagh, I want to have a look. We touched on it briefly yesterday. So the government, with cross-party support, has recognised the state of Palestine. And now, I suppose, the question from a lot of people is, well, then what's next? And one of the things that's come up is the Occupied Territories Bill. This is, you know, a proposal whereby, in effect, there would be a boycott for goods that are produced from illegal settlements on the occupied Palestinian territories. The government. Maybe you'd explain what the issue is, what the government's position is on this and what the purported block to it is.
Yeah, so my understanding is that with this piece of legislation and the BDS group, the Boycott, Divest and Sanction group, have a list there for people who want to just stay away from these products themselves without waiting for legislation. But all the goods that are coming into Ireland, it's all under European law, all the Common Customs Code and everything. And if you make a deviation to your market, that is going to throw out the ability of, say, a French seller of goods to Ireland who has these from getting them into the country, you could be opening up a European law can of worms. And that seems to be the government's line on this. Now, a lot of the time you can make the argument, well, look, try it, see what happens. Because there's nothing necessarily in our constitution that says that you can't not import stuff because they're from a certain country. It would fall between Europe and Ireland. So sometimes maybe it's down to just trying it and see what happens and to open that discussion about it. But it seems to be on that basis of, like, we don't want to reopen a whole Brexit issue over this legislation either, because it would be undoing some of the harmony that we have in the internal market.
All right. Do you know what advice was asked for Mary Siri Kearney from the Attorney General? Was it a case of how do we say no to the Occupied Territories Bill, or was it a case of could we do this if we wanted to, and if so, how would we go about it? And he just said, no, you can't do it.
Well, my understanding is because of the free movement of goods within the EU, it is not within our remit as a sole nation to actually implement a law for us as a member state, because we can't, for the very reasons that if it is a French importer or something like that, we're in a situation where we can't outlaw the import of bees that are affecting our native honeybee population because they're deemed as a product. So, you know, in the ways that Ireland has sought to exempt ourselves from the free movement of certain goods, we cannot do that.
Okay.
We need it to be done on an EU basis. And I would see there being hope and movement in that direction happening.
Richard Boyd-Barrett, you've had alternative legal advice on this, or there has been alternative legal advice made available on this subject. Have you seen it, and what's your legal counter-argument?
I haven't seen the detailed advice, but my understanding is...
We won't get into the case involving the port of Hamburg and imports from the occupied territories.
I won't, but what I'll say this is, I don't believe that when we're talking about a legally occupied territory, that the EU-Israel trade agreement covers it, right? So I don't accept that based on Ireland saying we do not want to have anything to do with goods that are coming from a legally occupied territory, that Europe could haul us legally over the coals successfully.
Your argument being that because Europe does not recognise the occupied territories as part of Israel,
nor does
the international...
They're not covered
therefore
under
that's
the agreement.
That's not covered.
They're not covered under the agreement. And we would be entirely legitimate in testing that proposition out by saying we're having nothing to do with them. But I want to add that as far as I'm concerned, we need to go further, because we're now talking about the context of a genocide. Okay, there should be a complete boycott of any trade, any relations, economic, political or otherwise, with Israel, given the genocide, given the apartheid, given the absolute brutality that regime has displayed.
Okay, you'd appreciate that then you are into the territory of the association agreement. But Cathalberry, very briefly, do you have a view on this before we go to the break?
Because
we
do have the question. What's the next step? The next step to me is try and get more people other than just Norway and Spain to recognise the state of Palestine. We know Belgium and Slovenia are considering their options, and I think we should support them in any way possible. The other factor to bear in mind that Joe Biden's Democratic convention will be on in August, and obviously he'll want the situation in the Middle East sorted by then, otherwise he'll be looking at major disruption during the convention when he's nominated for president. That's not a factor. We can't wait till August, though. Keep the pressure on, get as many European countries, get the momentum going, and let's get this state recognised and get peace brought to the region.
Okay, family care is being means tested for carers allowance. We're going to have a look at this after this.
The Late Debate with Cullum O'Mungon on RTE Radio 1.